Welcome to Below the 10, a series about life in South Los Angeles. Today's story is about faith. It's about a guy who's trying to do what he thinks is right in a divided world. The setting is a neighborhood called Jefferson Park, where a small congregation of African-American Muslims made a big decision about their mosque, and it divided their community. One member of the congregation, a man named Tariq Bilal, thought the decision was so profane that he went into a self-imposed exile. He believes that the imam's decision was in direct opposition to the will of God, but it was also personal. And a quick content advisory, there's nothing explicitly graphic, but there are parts of this story that mention drug use and the murder of a young woman. Here's the story of Tariq Bilal. In 2007, Jihad Safir became the imam of Masjid Ibadallah, a small storefront mosque located in the Jefferson Park neighborhood of Los Angeles. Jihad took over for his father, Sadiq, who founded the mosque in 1986. And when he took over, Jihad continued the traditions his father had started, and generally, things inside the mosque did not change dramatically. The same cannot be said for what was happening in the neighborhood outside the mosque.
That area, I can see it transforming. You can see it before our eyes transforming. You see people who you would normally not see there, but you know they're there in the community now. So we know what's perhaps going to take place in the near future.
To put it more bluntly, the neighborhood is gentrifying. On Jihad's website, above a picture of him in a suit and a tie, neatly trimmed beard, a kufi skull cap covering his shaved head, the mosque is described as a beacon of light in an area plagued by drug infestation and prostitution. But that's changing. When Jihad looked at this situation, he saw an opportunity. What if the storefront mosque wasn't a mosque anymore? What if it was a store?
It's really a no-brainer. I mean, we own the building. The overhead is not great because we're not going out and buying these products, but they're being given to us.
The idea was to open a thrift store, which would provide jobs for local residents, take advantage of the new money pouring in, and use those profits to fund an ambitious plan to expand the mosque and its role in the community. First, the congregation purchased an old middle school building a couple miles south of the mosque. They drew up plans to open a pre-K through 7th grade private school there and build a brand new mosque next to the building. So the storefront mosque on Jefferson had to be gutted and remodeled.
Was there people that were upset that missed the fact that it wasn't a mosque anymore?
Of course.
And perhaps no one was more opposed to Jihad's plan than Tariq Bilal.
This is unheard of. A masjid torn down by Muslims. If you get paradise for building a mosque, inshallah, what do you get for tearing one down?
Bilal is short but strong. He laughs a lot, and when he does, his right eye closes, giving the impression that he's winking at you. That and the gap in his front teeth make him look young. He's 71, but could easily pass for a man in his 50s, even though his thick beard is dangerously close to becoming more gray than black. When Bilal first found out about the imam's plans, he was furious that House of God was being turned into a business, for one. But he was also upset because the mosque was his home. He was the caretaker of the building. Every morning before dawn, he opened it up for prayers. He was also the adnan, the prayer caller. And sometimes, if the imam was running late, Bilal would even deliver the sermon. For 7 years, he lived inside the mosque, sleeping in a small room in the back of the building. And when the decision was made to close the mosque and move services into the new building on Slauson Avenue, Bilal refused to go, which meant that he had to find a new home.
And they didn't want me to, the cat raise up his back, so to speak, because I could have taken them to court because I received mail there, I lived there. So they knew I had them over a barrel.
The mosque paid Bilal $1,500, and he agreed to vacate the premises within 3.5 weeks. A contract was drawn up. Bilal and Jihad both signed it, and Bilal received his payment in 2 installments.
They gave me $750 as the final payment to move out. I don't think they knew I was going to move right in front.
I didn't tell them either.
I walked 4 feet.
4 feet is how far Bilal moved, though technically it's probably a little bit more than that. He moved into a 28-foot-long 1979 Winnebago RV, which he parked on the street directly in front of the mosque, effectively blocking the view of the building from the street. Jihad was not happy about it, but he was understanding.
You know, Bilal has earned us being patient, you know.
We just let him sit there as long as he needs to.
Hey, yeah, Bilal has earned that. You know, there's a saying from Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, he said, you know, the person who wants to be treated with mercy would treat others with mercy. You know, you don't get mercy unless you treat other people with mercy.
March came and went, then April, then it was summer, and Bilal was still parked out front when the demolition started. Every morning, he woke up to the sound of ceramic tile being smashed to pieces with a shovel, and Bilal let the workers know how he felt about their desecration of this house of God.
I don't even like them. They look at me like, I mean, I don't like what's gotten into you. I couldn't take the job to do it. I made the sign to go on the building. I can't even take the sign down.
Why?
Because I might cry. That noise is what used to be my home for 7 years.
So you live here, right in front of the mosque, and you have to listen to them tear it apart all day, every day. How does that not drive you crazy?
It drives me crazy. I'm going insane right now. I don't even come out.
And how come you don't just, like, move the RV somewhere where you don't have to hear it?
I never run.
There's a fine line between taking a principled stand and being stubborn. When I first met Bilal, I wasn't sure which side of that line he was on. I do believe that his ideological stance against turning the mosque into a business is sincere, but it wasn't clear to me what he hoped to accomplish by living in front of the building. He said he wasn't trying to keep customers away, and the store's profits were funding things like a food bank and a school for children, both efforts that Bilal supports. Over the last year and a half, I've spent a lot of time with Bilal and his RV, trying to understand this feud. And I think I've come to understand both sides of the dispute. But first, we need to go back. You should know about Bilal's life, because it's extraordinary. He's been a confidant to powerful celebrities. He's been a missionary, a husband to 6 wives, a father to 20 children, an artist, a devout religious scholar, and a fugitive. When Bilal was 16, he had his first encounter with Islam. Back then, his name was Ronald Walker, but everybody called him Ronnie. One day, an older friend lent him a book called Message to the Black Man in America. It was written by Elijah Muhammad, the leader of the Nation of Islam.
The more I read it, the more I became interested in it. But it was some things in it I didn't go along with, so I kind of kept that in the back of my head.
And Islam might still be nothing more than a thought in the back of Ronnie Walker's head. He probably wouldn't have converted to Islam if it weren't for an event that happened 6 years later, when he was 22 years old. It was February 1st, 1969. And when Ronnie woke up that morning, he had no idea it was going to be the worst day of his life. It was a Saturday. He was actually looking forward to a party at his sister's house.
I remember the family members being in the house, over my sister's house, and then later on meeting up over at my uncle's house.
At some point during the party, Ronnie's brother, his sister, and his uncle thought it would be funny to play a joke on him. So they put some LSD in his beer and gave it to him without telling him. Ronnie says he'd never taken LSD before that moment.
When it first hit me, everybody was still sitting around laughing and talking and getting high. And all of a sudden, it was like I was in a euphoria. In there by myself, and everybody else was part of the movie. I remember that part of it. And later on, I guess it more got in my system or something, and that's when the situation occurred.
He doesn't remember what happened after that. He didn't find out until 3 days later.
I didn't even know that I was being pursued to be arrested. I walked the street for 3 days, and they arrested me coming in the side door at my mother's house. I didn't even know they were looking for me.
What he found out is that while he was on LSD, he shot and killed his uncle's girlfriend, a woman in her 20s named Shirley Ann Williams.
They had to tell me what I did and tell me what the scene was. And I'm telling you what they told me now. The only part that I remember was when I went into this euphoria. And that was the last thing that I remember. They told me I pulled the gun out and shot the person, and that was it. They said I said something to them, and they were on the ground. I shot them again and left. So I confessed to something that I didn't even know I did, to somebody told me that I did.
Ronnie's attorney argued that he was under diminished capacity. In other words, he was temporarily mentally impaired when he shot Shirley Ann Williams. California has since outlawed the use of the diminished capacity plea. But in Ronnie's case, it worked. He was found guilty, but because of the diminished capacity plea, his sentence was reduced to second-degree murder, and he was sentenced to 7 years in prison. When he got out, he says his brother, sister, and uncle, the ones who'd put the acid in his beer, were all struggling with heroin addiction.
I think they all died within a year, all over heroin-related incidents. Now, I escaped the heroin, so maybe I was supposed to be in prison. Now, when you look back on it, I don't think I was arrested. I think I was rescued.
In prison, Bilal started reading the Quran, and this time it stuck, especially the story of Bilal. Bilal was a black Ethiopian born into slavery in Mecca at the end of the 6th century. After he heard the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad, he became one of the first converts to Islam. And because of Bilal's newfound faith, he was tortured by his master, who stripped him naked, staked his limbs to the hot sands of the Arabian desert, and placed a heavy rock on his chest to try to get him to renounce his faith. But it didn't work. Bilal just kept shouting, "Ahad, Ahad, one God, one God." When Ronnie Walker read this story of Bilal in prison, he saw himself.
I guess identifying with the slavery that my ancestors went through over here, identifying with the situation that I may have been in at the time that I accepted Islam. I was in prison. My back was against a wall. I felt like the prison was a big rock that was on my chest.
Ronnie Walker changed his name to Tyreek Bilal. This was just one of the many transformations he's gone through. But throughout his life, there has always been one constant. Whether he was little Ronnie Walker or Tyreek Bilal, he has always cut hair.
My father was a barber, and I've been a barber since very, very early age. I knew how to cut hair before my father even loaned me a pair of clippers.
When he was 12 years old, his dad got him a job at an upscale barber shop in Beverly Hills. This was the 1950s, and a lot of the customers were famous.
I tell you, Ray Charles got mad at me one time in the barber shop because I didn't know who he was.
Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin were regulars.
Ronald Reagan was a frequent customer. The Kennedys, Bobby Kennedy, Ted Kennedy.
When a customer came into the shop, Ronnie would take their jacket, hang it up, and then after their haircut, he would go up to the customer with a small hand broom and brush any stray hairs off their suit.
It was all eyes on me at that point, right? Because some of these people didn't like the tip. I didn't know they were rich and I was poor. One guy, he would never want to give me nothing, right? And I would stand there and beat on his change pocket and make a lot of noise, and the whole shop would just fall out. He said, "Ronnie at it again. Somebody must not be tipping." I'd be wearing his change pocket out with that whisper. Right? I enjoyed my time out there in Beverly Hills. Yeah, it was really something.
On May 2nd of this year, a full 14 months after Bilal moved out of the mosque. I found him cutting hair in his RV.
He wants an urgent appointment.
It's really nice inside. He put a lot of money into remodeling the interior. It's got wood floors, leather couches, there's custom artwork on the walls. And by this time, the thrift store had opened, and the RV was still blocking the view of the building from the street. Bilal's friend Lawrence, a fellow member of the mosque, was seated inside the RV, wearing a smock, while Bilal stood above him with a pair of clippers in his hand. I asked Lawrence where he stood on the feud between Bilal and the Imam, and he thought about it for a while, as if he were being levitated to a higher vantage point, where he could see the true nature of the dispute. He said, for starters, there aren't enough mosques in Los Angeles.
We need more houses of God in the communities. When you build a house for God from the ground up, that's all it's supposed to ever be. But this wasn't built for that. It was built, it was something else before it became a masjid. So to turn it back into something else, it's not a sin. It's maybe a misunderstanding, but it's not a sin.
What do you think about Bilal parking in front of the thrift store?
They should talk, and then they should do justice to each other. And they know what justice is. That's all I can say.
I mean, do you see your parking here as like an effort to stop the thrift store from succeeding, or?
No, I couldn't stop Allah's plan from succeeding. If he wants you to add a customer, he send them around this RV. Or around any indignation that I would have concerning the house of God being turned into the house of Shaitan, the marketplace. No, I didn't go along with it in the beginning. I don't go along with it now, and I will never go along with selling out your religion for worldly gain.
As for the Imam, he thinks one of the reasons Bilal and the other members of the congregation are upset about his plans is a generational divide. He was only 25 years old when he took over as Imam. Today he's 35, half Bilal's age.
Us, you know, we're products of the internet. Our vision has been exposed to, you know, the saying, the sky's the limit. And you have an older generation who, you know, they're satisfied with, say, a smaller building. And that's not everyone from the older generation, but I think that's what it, you know, boils down to, is just difference in visions.
When Bilal was released from prison in 1977, he was 32 years old. He started working with a hairstylist who had several celebrity clients, including Dick Griffey. Griffey was the founder and CEO of Solar. Solar was an acronym for Sounds of Los Angeles Records. The label was often called the Motown of the 80s. And under Griffey, the label had a number of very successful acts. Bands like The Whispers and Shalimar, Babyface. And Griffey took a liking to Bilal and hired him to be his personal barber. Later in his life, Griffey became a mentor to Suge Knight and helped him start Death Row Records. And like his mentor, Suge Knight also hired Bilal to be his personal barber and the in-house barber for Death Row Records. But as a devout Muslim, the transition from Solar to Death Row Records wasn't easy for Bilal.
Being a part of Death Row Records is like being a part of this world. It's like a microcosm of the slime that's going through society. To have women sent to your room, and you have to let them go sleep on the couch over there and not sex them, because you don't want to be a part of that degradation. To advise people to do the right thing, and they laugh at you and still go do the wrong thing.
Did you just do it for the money then?
I don't have any.
But at the time?
I made more money from other directions than...
If it wasn't fun and it wasn't profitable, why were you doing that?
No. You carried me too fast. You slick, though. I give you credit. If it wasn't profitable and it wasn't fun, why was I doing it? I was doing it for God. I was doing it for God because God told me to approach the people that didn't have the knowledge of Him, give them the knowledge of Him.
So are you saying you were kind of like a missionary in Death Row Records for Islam?
Yes, that's what it was. And everybody knew it too.
After 15 years, Bilal quit working for Death Row Records. He continued to run his own salon in Inglewood. But over the next few years, his life started to unravel. He spent a lot of time preaching to others about how they should behave, but he himself was failing to live up to those same standards.
I guess I was at my wit's end again in life. You know, I saw things were not going right. I had gone through four wives, and I had vowed to do a certain thing, and I wasn't doing what I had vowed to do completely. I was smoking weed and drinking a beer every now and then.
So Bilal went to the mosque on Jefferson and asked if they would take him in, and they did. Bilal became the caretaker. The mosque even paid him a couple hundred dollars a month. So Bilal closed his salon and moved into the mosque, which at first felt a lot like prison.
Yeah, in the sense that I had a commitment, I had to make up my mind, and I had to do what I said I was going to do to try to change my life. I did the same thing going to prison.
When Bilal went to prison nearly 40 years earlier, he spent a lot of his time painting.
I never had art class. I taught myself how to paint in jail.
And now that he wasn't cutting hair full time, he had more time to paint. Portraits, the occasional landscape. And then in 2009, he got a big commission to paint a mural on the wall of Compton's City Hall. It's still there, a towering portrait of President Obama with the White House and an American flag rippling in the background. And when Bilal wasn't painting, he mostly studied.
It was one spot I would sit reading Quran, and I started to get butt prints in the carpet, right? So I had to move my spot and try to get the butt prints out, right? Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
In the Quran, it says that Bilal had such a beautiful voice that the Prophet Muhammad chose him to be Islam's first prayer caller. And Bilal is the star in one of Islam's greatest moments in history. When Muhammad's army succeeded in conquering the city of Mecca, it was Bilal who climbed to the top of the structure at the center of the mosque. And for the first time in Mecca, Islam's holiest city, a Muslim gave the call to prayer.
Ashhadu anna Muhammadan Rasulullah.
And like Bilal from the Quran, Bilal on Jefferson Boulevard was asked to be the prayer caller of the mosque he lived in.
Ashhadu anna Muhammadan Rasulullah.
At this point in Bilal's life, everything was going well. He had shelter, economic security. People admired his voice and his dedication to Islam. And he had purpose, opening the mosque every morning before dawn, singing the call to prayer. And Bilal came to rely on the structure of his life at the mosque. It kept him on the godly path he'd been striving for ever since converting to Islam. And then suddenly this decision was made to close down the mosque, and Bilal just couldn't go along with it.
What we wanted another way? Of course. Of course. What don't we want another way? I mean, this is life.
Again, Imam Jihad Safir.
This is life, and then what do you do? What do you do? I mean, we're taught to sue each other. You know, we're taught to harm each other if we don't agree with each other. We are taught to sabotage each other. And we're all victims of that type of mentality, you know, and hopefully... You know, there's some good that's going to come out of all of this. You know, we just had to be patient to see.
A few weeks ago, I stopped by the thrift store to visit Bilal. But when I turned onto the street, I could see the building clearly. 18 months after he'd parked in front of the thrift store, his RV was gone.
The police came over there one day and marked everybody's tires with that blue chalk. So they marked everybody.
You didn't really decide to move. You were kind of forced.
Oh, they get your ass up out of here. Everybody leave. And we're coming back in 3 days with tow trucks. We're not even coming to give y'all no tickets.
Bilal didn't go far. He was just parked across the street. He's still angry about the situation. But now that they've started enforcing parking, he can't keep blocking the view of the thrift store. He could go anywhere, but the reality is that Bilal is afraid to leave the block.
And I feel safe here. Suppose I get somewhere else and people don't know me. They make me move every 2 days. The next thing I know, I'm going to be pushing the basket or sitting on the street because they'll take this away. And so that's probably why I stay here right now. Because economically, my disposition won't let me move.
There's one other reason Bilal has decided to stay on this block. He's lonely.
Right now, it's waiting on the wife. And I've been married 6 times, so wife number 7, she should be a jewel.
Bilal says that all 6 of his ex-wives will tell you pretty much the same thing. That overall, he was a good guy and a good father. But he wasn't around as much as he could have been. And now he's in love with a woman who lives down the street, a school teacher who has a small Islamic school. And she knows how he feels.
And she wants to marry me too, but she's playing the role that I probably should be playing. So that's telling me I have to go and get some money if I want this particular wife. So I even went and bought a lotto ticket. You know, I wasn't supposed to do that. I'm a gambler. I just bought one.
From Bilal's new parking spot, the view out his front door is a nice little park next to the library. On a recent afternoon, I found him sitting in the RV looking out the open door. While we were talking, a guy walked up and asked Bilal if he'd found his cell phone.
I lost my phone. You wouldn't happen to find a phone like LG?
He was distraught. He said there were photos on the phone that would prove his innocence in a crime he was accused of. He was short, maybe 5'6", but had the build of a weightlifter. He looked similar to photos I've seen of Bilal when he was younger. The guy said he'd gotten out of prison recently. He had a large cross tattooed on his forearm, and Bilal asked if he'd been going to church. The man said only once since he got out. Bilal urged him to go back.
Now, how would a Muslim sit up here and tell you to go to church? Go, homie.
I just walked in, and I said, oh, man, I can't do this. And I walked in.
And then this guy opened up to Bilal. He said he was at the end of his rope. He just had an argument at work and lost his job. He threw his hands in the air and said he was basically just ready to die.
I'm ready, because I've lived my life. That's the way I feel.
Try to get another 30 in, and be sitting here telling somebody your age the same story I'm telling you.
And,
please,
because
you're valuable. They can't break you.
It's like I'm trying to be good, but I'm still...
Yeah, I know.
Like, up.
Me too. I'm 71. Me
that.
Too. I'm still messing up. I want to do something to people and all kind of shit. So I'm telling you, I got the same problem you got. I just got 40 more years of it.
Eventually, the man left, headed up the street to meet a friend. Bilal looked out the open door at the new view from his RV. A father stood in the grass watching his daughter climb onto the exercise equipment, staying just close enough to catch her if she fell.
We have a lot of social diseases on Jefferson, and I probably have a couple of them myself. I don't know, because I'm trying to eradicate them. I know they start in the heart. You know, because the heart, it sends the mind to get what it wants. It has to obey its passions. I don't know which way it's going to go. Maybe God will take this and turn it into a beautiful thing.
Allahu
Allahu Akbar. La ilaha illallah.
This project is supported by a grant from the Conrad N. Hilton Foundation. You can find more about the series at belowthe10.com. That's T-E-N. There you'll find tons of fantastic visual elements. There's videos and photos of some of the people in the series. There's interactive maps and beautiful illustrations. The series was reported and produced by me, David Weinberg, with Alexandra Garriton. It was edited by Sonia Geis and Nick White. And the digital team was run by Caitlin Schamberg. Thanks for listening.